Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to the inaugural lecture of the Thomistic Institute of Baylor University. My name is Adam Myers, and I am the sort of president of the Thomistic Institute here at Baylor, and we're quite excited to start this event today to introduce the Thomistic Institute to Baylor and to have Russ Hittinger here to do our inaugural lecture. So my thanks to you for coming out today. Now, to introduce our speaker is John Haldane, who I now want to have come up here.
Before I introduce our speaker, first of all, I really want to congratulate Adam on the good work that he has done, the role that he's played in organizing not only this event, but more generally establishing this presence of the Thomistic Institute. As he says, this is something that really originated in Washington, D.C., out of the Dominicans there. And it's been spreading and growing very rapidly. And that's testament, I think, to their good efforts, but also to the fact that the time is ready for this. And around the country, around the United States, I meet many students at both undergraduate and graduate level who are developing an interest in Aquinas and want to know more. And so I think this is a forum, as a place in which you can encounter thinkers who've done work on Aquinas, who can expound both the content and the method of Aquinas and so on. That's all going to be very valuable. But also, as has been suggested, a broader introduction and immersion, really, into the Catholic conception of intellectual inquiry. Some of you will know that Leo XIII, in his encyclical that really brought the study of Aquinas back into, as it were, into attention and as a practice, Eterni Patris, in the course of that, he commended Aquinas as a patron for all Roman Catholic educational institutions, schools, colleges, universities, and so on. But I think among all the post-apostolic figures, Aquinas, more than anybody else, is someone whom Christians of all denominations could treat perhaps as a patron or as an intellectual model, such as the breadth and sophistication of his thought, but also the way in which he weaves together and combines the study of Scripture and the insights of Scripture with metaphysics, with moral philosophy, with theology, and so on. So I think he's a very fitting figure for Christians of whatever caste and stripe. Your speaker today I first met, in fact, in another Thomistic Institute, I suppose we could call it of a type, a Thomistic seminar that used to be run every summer for a number of years at the University of Notre Dame. Russ Hittinger was himself a graduate of the University of Notre Dame, 1975, with honours. But one of his teachers there was Ralph McInerney, a very famous figure, really, in Catholic intellectual culture in the United States, and particularly in the study of Aquinas. And Ralph McInerney used to run a summer seminar there and would bring people from different parts of the world, mostly from the United States, but I was happy to be able to join that company and first met Russ Hittinger there. Intermittently, we meet again. We were just reminding ourselves, most recently, I think, in the gardens of the Vatican. The reason for that is that Russ is a senior figure in the Pontifical Academy of Thomas Aquinas and also in the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. I'm a member of a couple of academies, Pontifical Academies, one of those being the Thomas Aquinas one. But these academies meet in this very fine 16th century villa in the gardens of the Vatican, and from where it's possible to both imaginatively enter into the sense of a universal church, but also an eternal city. But also along with that, I think, as one sits in a 16th century villa, to recognize that this doesn't represent the totality of the reality of the world. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about Professor Hittinger's work is the way in which, as well as drawing upon the perennial wisdom, the tradition of Aquinas, Church Fathers and others, Augustine, he also has an alertness that isn't always the case among people who take their inspiration from the past. He has an alertness to the changing conditions of the present, and I think principally among those, a sensitivity to the enormous social, intellectual, cultural changes that have been wrought in the 20th century, and increasingly, and at an accelerating rate. particularly globalization on the one hand, and on the other, the draining away of Christian culture from many countries in which it was formative, including the United States. So I think that there must have been occasions in which he's sitting there in Rome thinking, well, indeed, this is, in a sense, the ancient city of the world and also the center of a great culture and a great religion, but also one that is in change in time for changing world. His own work has been, he's been a prolific writer and worked across a range of fields, but broadly moral, social, and political philosophy, legal philosophy also, but with informed by a knowledge of social science and a knowledge of history. You'll get a sense of the kind of thing that he's been doing if I just mention some of the titles. A Critique of the New Natural Law Theory, that's a famous book of his in 1987, which was inserted itself into an ongoing debate among Thomists around the nature of ethics, and no doubt, even if that isn't a matter for discussion today, it will be a matter for discussion on some future occasion here, I suspect. And then another work, The First Grace, Rediscovering Natural Law in a Post-Christian Age. Thomas Aquinas and the Rule of Law, Toward an Adequate Anthropology, Social Aspects of Imago Dei in Catholic Theology, Catholic Social Doctrine and the Modern State. I see that he's had the prudence in his title for today to use the term a rather than the. John Rawls, the great American political philosopher, famously, when he came to write his work on the theory of justice, didn't term it the theory of justice, but a theory of justice, modestly recognizing that there were rival theories of justice. I'm not sure whether it's rival conceptions of a Catholic approach to the problem of social justice that leads Russ here to use A, which we'll discover shortly. But at any rate, I give you a lecture and his title, so Professor Russell Hittinger and his title, The Problem of Social Justice, A Catholic Approach. Welcome.
My thanks to these two eminent Thomists, John Haldane and Thomas Hibbs. One of them should be giving the inaugural lecture, but the last shall be first. I also congratulate all the work that Adam is doing on the organization of the Thomistic Institute here at Baylor. Speaking of Ralph McInerney, when I was a Callow undergraduate at Notre Dame, in his first class, he discussed or presented to us the syllogism of the Mad Thomist, and I've never forgotten it, because I think it was in reference to himself. The syllogism of the Mad Thomist is, all wisdom is in the mind of the angelic doctor. I know the mind of the angelic doctor. You will have to hang on until I get to why I say a Catholic approach. You have the handout as well, right? I'll refer to those in due course. Societies that were formed in the tradition of Roman law, most of continental Europe, once upon a time had a clear social, moral, and juridical understanding of the word solidarity. One had an obligatio in solidum when he was responsible, that is to say, liable for the debts or actions of another person. Solidarity, once upon a time, was not a limited liability partnership. A legal and moral presumption of solidarity depended upon one's membership in a society, a nation, a family, a religion, or perhaps a guild that persists over time, allowing everyone else to deem them members of some corporate whole. The uncle, for example, could be responsible for the actions and debts of his niece. And until 1800, Jews in Europe could have obligations in solidum simply by virtue of being Jews. Liberation from presumptions of solidarity, especially the odious ones pertaining to Jews, was a notable work of the democratic revolutions that spread from France to the rest of Europe and her former colonies. The Napoleonic Code forbade the presumption of solidarities because it threatened the solidarity of citizens based upon the new creed of liberty, equality, and fraternity. The code permitted only those liabilities contracted by individuals for limited purposes and times. You could say the beginning of liberalism is, in a way, in the Napoleonic Code. No more presumption of solidarity, only of limited liability in contracts. But having destroyed the legal basis of presumptive solidarities that are reducible neither to the state or individual contract, the revolutions unintentionally emancipated the word solidarity, which quickly acquired a plethora of moral and ideological meanings in the 19th and 20th centuries. Solidarity of class, solidarity of political parties, political movements, sex and gender solidarity, even the solidarity of humanity itself. For Catholic social doctrine, it took many years to get comfortable with the word solidarity after it had mutated into these various meanings. In fact, it was first used by the Pontifical Magisterium in Mater et Magistra, 1961, you know, almost two centuries later. It finally shows up in a papal encyclical. Since then, since 1961, in Catholic thought, the word solidarity can mean, on the one hand, brotherhood, or a social bond of cooperation, such as fellowship among workers in the same profession. On the other hand, solidarity is referred to as a principle governing the sharing and distribution of goods. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, 1997, for example, says that solidarity denotes friendship or social charity, whereby two or more people are constituted in and participate in a social bond. And it also means the right distribution of goods. Thus, two related but very distinct kinds of justice are included under a single term. First, the justice of what members owe to the community, the common good. And second, what a given society owes to its individual members, regarded things to be divided and distributed on the basis of merit and need. The term social justice also entered the papal vocabulary rather late in the game, 1931 to be exact. It too adopts the same Janus-based perspective that I just noted regarding the term solidarity. In fact, if you look at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, solidarity and social justice are treated in tandem. Depending on the context, social justice can mean the justice of maintaining and defending a common social order. So I find a 1904 reference to these two words, social justice, in an encyclical by Pius X, commemorating the 1300th anniversary of the death of Pope Gregory the Great. Gregory, he said, opposed energetically the unjust claims of the Byzantine emperors. He checked the audacity and curbed the shameless avarice of exarchs and imperial administrators and stood up in public as a defender of social justice. Justitia socialis. But beginning in the 1930s, this very same term came to mean not only giving the common good what is its due, but also the distribution of economic and social benefits to individual persons and classes of persons. It came to mean just what everyone thinks social justice means today, in or out of the church: distributive justice, taking divisible things and rightly apportioning them or allotting them. And here is the beginning of a problem that I want to talk about, a problem from which many confusions have arisen, especially since the 1960s, when Catholic social doctrine retreated not only from the older scholastic philosophy that once governed the meaning and use of terms like justice or social justice, but it also retreated from philosophical rigor altogether. The current use of the term social justice by the magisterium, if not by ordinary Catholics, deeply confuses relations of love and justice in an indivisible social order with relations of love and justice regarding divisible things, so long as that confusion obtains, it will be very difficult to sustain any kind of consistent social ontology. So, let me explain. John Paul II was not the first pope to use the term social justice, but he was the first to use it not only persistently, but also doctrinally, by which I mean he defined solidarity as a virtue, and he tried to mark analogous meanings of this virtue. In Solicitudo Rei Socialis, 1987, the virtue of solidarity is described initially as a willingness to make a moral response to common goods, in the plural. It is above all, he wrote, a question of interdependence. But solidarity is undoubtedly a Christian virtue, he also argues. Beyond human and natural bonds, already so close and strong, there is discerned in the light of faith a new model of the unity of the human race, which must ultimately inspire our solidarity. So as we can see, the Pope uses a single word to flag a plurality of social virtues perfecting actions regarding what two or more people might have in common. And as I've read through the tradition, post-1961, I find at least four recurring meanings of the word solidarity, and they're all going to bear on the problem of social justice. Solidarity can mean, in the first place, something anthropological, that is, our common ontological perfections as human. These perfections, rational, free, communicative animals, are a wellspring for all recognitions upon which various kinds of solidarity depend, and according to which we can understand the love of oneself and one's neighbor. It's very Thomistic, because when Thomas in the Prima Secundae, question 94, article 2, gives the very first example of an inclination that grounds the precept of the natural law, he says, not to preserve ourselves, but to preserve ourselves according to our species. And therefore, at the very grounding of love and justice is a kind of humanism. We all love the species that's found in every individual member of it. All love, in a way, for others begins with a love of our own kind. And it marks some kind of important threshold, allowing us to love other persons we scarcely know, and with whom we live in no specific or familiar social world. That's a very deep meaning of solidarity. It's kind of the love of the humanity in each person and in ourselves. A second meaning that's found continually in the literature is simply called interdependence. In the words of Gaudium et Spes from Vatican II, it's called needful solidarity. In short, we're all in the same boat together. And these interdependencies readily suggest solutions requiring our solidarity based upon work, exchange, distributions, public regulations. And to some extent, this kind of solidarity also can be initiated and appropriated from afar with people with whom we're not familiar. The third meaning of solidarity is communicative and irreducibly moral. That is, common activities which can encompass rather diverse modes of cooperation, partnership, friendship, associations. In Centesimus Annus, which was written on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum of Leo, John Paul speaks of the expanding chain of solidarity. That is, once there's a certain kind of social communication, it tends to diffuse itself into other communications. The fourth meaning is communion, communio. That is, a common love in which the union between two or more people is what is loved. Not just the other person, but communion with them. The Greeks would call it koinonia. That is, a common life, a common good. Recent magisterial documents emphasize the agapic character of love specific to Christianity. But of course, there are modes of common good love that aim at the love of union with another person without being necessarily supernatural. So what's the problem? A society is brimming with different kinds of solidarity. But the fourth kind of solidarity, in which what is loved is a union with the other person, is not only qualitatively different than the first three, but is also vulnerable to being confused or reduced to the others. And that could be a problem. A society constituted by koinonia or communio has a different logic. Its distinguishing characteristic is that its union is without qualification the common good, or what the tradition called bonum commune. And therefore, it's sustained by a different species of justice and benevolence than the other kinds of solidarity. The Catholic tradition has held that there are three such societies that are called necessary societies, that are based upon bonum commune and have as their sustaining logic a love of union: marriage and family, polity and church. These are called necessary societies because our membership in them is necessary for eudaimonia, or happiness. By nature, human beings are matrimonial animals, political animals, and by grace created in the soul, ecclesial animals. These three societies, which are the seats of human happiness, each have their own respective ends and social forms. But what they all have in common that sets them apart from the other solidarities is their common good is an indivisible thing. It's a union. It's not something divisible. Like any true friendship, I'm thinking of Aristotle here, there's only one way to have a common good, and that's to participate in it by action. It can have no other mode of existence. The common good never exists as a private good. And therefore, when someone exits a marriage or a polity, he cannot take away his private share. Even in our somewhat demented, or in any case, confused legal cultures today, courts understand perfectly well that they can divide and distribute the external properties of the marriage. The husband gets the channel changer, the wife gets the dining room table. But the matrimonial society itself cannot be divided. It would have to be annulled or dissolved. It can't be divided. You can't ask for 35% of your marriage. It's ontologically impossible. It is not a divisible thing of that sort. You can renounce your citizenship, become a citizen of another country, but you can't take 10% of it. You can only have 100% of citizenship, even if you hold two. You can only have 100% of the two citizenships. Common good societies and solidarities cannot be redistributed. Now, to be sure, societies having a common good also engage in exchanges and distributions according to their own form and order of their union. A matrimonial union does not merely beget children, but does so matrimonially. A polity does not aim merely to secure peace and security of the city, but to do so politically, that is, constitutionally according to a shared form. So when a polity makes free legal counsel available to the indigent in criminal cases, almost all relatively well-developed legal systems would allow the poor to receive free legal counsel in criminal cases. And in that case, we can distribute more or less of legal counsel. They're scads of lawyers. We can assign them to different cases. But we cannot say that the rule of law is distributed to individual persons. The rule of law is not a divisible thing. So, question. Does social justice chiefly pertain to the indivisible aspects of a common good and what we owe to it? Or does it pertain chiefly to the divisible aspects of social life? Without question, for the better part of the history of Catholic social doctrine, it pertained to the indivisible. So let me tell that part of the story. From one point of view, every species of justice is social, because justice is not a thing, but rather a relation. So, according to the Roman jurisprudence going all the way back to Justinian, what is justice? Jus suum quique tribuere. That is, to give to each person his due or right, what is owed to him, to each person. Justice cannot be accomplished unless and until we align a three-factored relation. We have to know who the giver is, that is, who is obligated. We have to know who the recipient is. And we have to know what the thing given is, the so-called res justum, money, status, or whatever it might be. Each factor is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for justice being done. So, for example, if I find a $50 bill on the street, I know who the giver is, who is obligated. That's me. It doesn't belong to me. And I certainly know what ought to be given. The $50 bill, but I don't know who to give it to. Justice is not done. That's not to say it's an injustice, but justice has not been accomplished until the giver, the recipient, and the thing to be given are aligned. And traditionally, this threefold relation has three different modes to it. Going back to Aristotle. In commutative justice, which is the justice of exchange, you and I reciprocally give and receive. Each of us are both givers and recipients. And commutative justice certainly applies to divisible things. In fact, that's what it's mostly all about. Ordinary contract law. In distributive justice, however, the agent is not you and me bilaterally. It's us, family, church, polity, or whatever the association or society might be. And it pertains to what we owe our individual members on the basis of merit or need. In a family, for example, the medicine is given to the sick child. It's on the basis of need. It is not given to the wealthy child or to the healthy child. It's given to the sick child. Civic honors are given to those who perform heroic, not ordinary, service, and so forth. Now, on distributive justice, there's a few points that are very important to understand. It's not an exchange. Medicine is not distributed to the child who can pay for it, but to the sick child. It's not an exchange. And we wouldn't think that the hero who deserves the medal in combat has paid for his medal. Like every mode of justice, virtue inheres in the giver, not the recipient, which is hard for us to understand because of our language of rights, I suppose. The virtue of justice is the person who is obligated rightly satisfying the obligation. And therefore, the net aggregation of market consequences at any given slice of time might be just, but it's not distributive justice. No one's giving. It's simply an anonymous catalaxy of a market that in any slice of time is at. Distribution is nothing other than the net effect of all of the exchanges. That is not what the tradition meant by distributive justice. Furthermore, the word redistributive is a misnomer. We should never use the term redistribution. It either is just needlessly redundant, for distributive justice in any community is always dynamic because the proportions of merit or need continually change. So, of course, distributive justice is always redistributive justice. It's being changed all the time. Or redistribution means that the original distribution was nothing other than the net effect of exchanges, which we need then to alter by virtue of distributive justice. This is why free marketeers, liberals of that sort, always like to use the term redistribution, because what they believe is the original distribution is just the net effect of market exchanges, and therefore government, when it distributes, is coming in and altering the market. But we should never use the term redistribution. It's simply not accurate. It's just distribution. Third, the term subsidiarity is a limit on distributive justice. That is, when someone has an obligation to give subsidium, help, or assistance, there's a limit. Namely, that when a good thing is distributed, it must not destroy or derange the community's being assisted. Subsidiarity should never be seen from the bottom up. It's a complete mistake, sorry to say. It should be seen from the standpoint of the giver, which is usually a higher community. That is, when the giver distributes subsidium, help, he should not destroy or derange those being helped. Now, according to St. Thomas, the justice of exchange and the justice of distribution fall under the cardinal virtue of justice, because each gives to the other what is his due. The Latin term, sub specie alteritatis, under the aspect of someone being other. Justice is done when the right thing is put into the possession of the right person, either bilaterally, by exchange, or by distribution on the basis of merit or need. And the social world could not be sustained unless we really do give to each other what is their due, precisely as other. But there's another virtue of justice, which Thomas calls legal or general, that can't be put under the cardinal virtue. And this is quote number one on your handout. Legal or general justice is said to be a general virtue inasmuch as it directs the acts of other virtues to its own end, and this is to move all the other virtues by its command. For just as charity may be called a general virtue insofar as it directs the acts of all the virtues to the divine good, so too is legal justice, insofar as it directs the acts of all of the virtues to the common good. Accordingly, just as charity, which regards the divine good as its proper object, is a special virtue in respect of its essence, so too legal is a special virtue of justice in respect of its essence, insofar as it regards the common good as its proper object. So, the practice of this virtue, looked at from a social point of view, sub spe societatis, is called legal because law always directs for the common good, and is called general because the other virtues are mobilized to the good of the common good, of the union of two or more members. And that's why general justice or common good justice can't be put under the cardinal virtue. Common good justice has a different logic. Why? The common good is not other. A true common good is not other than the individuals who participated. Therefore, it can't be a cardinal virtue. It might sound paradoxical, but the cardinal virtues of justice in exchange and distribution would destroy common good justice if the common good is depicted as something other. Or, let me put it another way. If we only had two kinds of cardinal virtue justice, justice of exchange and justice of distribution, we would still be social animals. But that fourth kind of solidarity that the tradition calls koinonia or communia would not exist, precisely because common good is not other. It does not have its proximate root in exchange and distribution. Common good cannot be distributed, at least not as a divisible thing. Now, I want to give one example out of Dante, who was an astute reader of Thomas's distinction between cardinal virtue of justice, right exchange and right distribution, and what Thomas calls legal or general justice. This is from the Purgatorio, where Dante meets up with the shadow of Guido del Duca, a really tough politician from the Romagna, who laments the fratricidal politics in the city of his region, which he attributes to the envy of Cain. Then, in Canto 15, Dante turns to Virgil to explain what Guido just said. And here's the quote. "I thought I'd gather profit from his words. And even as I turned toward him, I asked, what did that spirit of Romagna mean when he said, sharing cannot have a part? And his reply, he knows the harm that lies in his worst vice. For when your longings center on things such that sharing them apportions less to each, then envy stirs the bellows of your sigh. But if the love within the highest sphere should turn your longings heavenward, the fear inhabiting your breast would disappear. For there, the more there are who can say ours, so much greater is the good possessed by each, so much more love burns in that cloister." And so I take Virgil's teaching to mean something like this. In strict cardinal virtue justice, each shall have what is his own. The lust for what belongs to the other gives rise to envy, and we can't be right with our neighbor by taking or wishing to destroy what is his. And love needs the cardinal virtue of justice for the simple reason that we cannot enjoy unions when there is injustice. The cure is not to subvert strict justice, much less to make everything common in the same respect. Things truly divisible must in justice be divided and assigned to each according to his own. What is common, however, requires a different justice and love. And it was Signore del Duca stationed in purgatory to learn this lesson. The lesson, once learned and socially completed, is found in the Paradiso of Dante, where the saints are grouped in two ways. First, in their respective grades of participation. That is, the saints are ranked according to merit. Everyone shall have, even in heaven, what is his due. But at the end, in the celestial rows, all the saints are gathered together in a circle, spinning circle, like a shaker dance, in which they are not ranked according to their merit, but by their participation in the common good. This is what Guido del Duca had to learn. Dante knew the mind of St. Thomas. Justice of exchange and distribution must be distinguished carefully and rigorously from common good justice. Now, in the late 19th century, some Catholic scholars, clerical and lay, sent a letter to Leo XIII voicing reservations about the traditional term denoting common good justice. Legal justice, they worried, could suggest that only the state has bonum commune, because of course the state's special obligation is law. And this was the era of Bismarck, when the church was hard pressed to sustain its own societies against the effort of states to sweep all solidarities into that of citizenship. And so to avoid a misunderstanding, they proposed to rename legal or general justice social justice. Actually, it made some sense, because general justice, in which all of us enjoy an indivisible common good, is most elegantly and powerfully social. Leo XIII said, "You're crazy. I'm not changing terminology used by the angelic doctor." The lobbying continued to happen in succeeding decades, and the terminological change officially took place during the pontificate of Pius XI. Now, he was very reluctant to start calling general justice social justice, and in fact made clear in an encyclical on the importance of teaching St. Thomas that justitia socialis is nothing other than justitia legalis, or generalis. Quote, "It's of the essence of social justice to demand from each individual all that is necessary for the common good." As this terminological change was moved down the field of history and social policy, the ball was almost guaranteed to be fumbled. In the first place, in the Great Depression and its aftermath, economic disorder galvanized everyone's attention on the issues of exchange and distribution, especially the state's role in remediating imbalances in distribution. It was almost inevitable that distributive justice would absorb social justice. In the second place, the term social justice in the English-speaking world, since the mid-19th century, read John Stuart Mill, had already come to mean distributive justice, especially with regard to the weak and the vulnerable. It would have been a Sisyphean task of Pius XI, despite his intense qualifications, to make social justice mean anything other than distributive justice in that time and place. And the result was predictable. The concept and term common good was not lost. Rather, the term specifically denoting its particular mode of justice was confusedly put under distribution. So rather than having three kinds of justice, each with its own kind of love, we become reduced to two: justice of exchange and contract, and justice of public distribution, or what is more likely now called redistribution. On this view, we are compelled to speak of those solidarities having koinonia in terms that misrepresent the actions and virtues that truly sustain them. Indeed, marriage, family, polity, and church are not founded in the first place just on exchange and distribution, but on a consent to a union, participation in a union. In fact, the three great societies can turn out looking like little more than public utilities, about which we debate equities and efficiencies in terms of distributing important goods. Over these decades, 1930s and through the 1950s, many Thomistic philosophers noted that the conflation of distributive justice with common good, or general justice, was more than a terminological mistake. I refer you to quote number 3, which I'm not going to read, but there's interesting quotes from Luigi Sturzo and Joseph Pieper. In fact, by the end of the 1950s, many Catholic thinkers understood that calling social justice what you mean by distributive justice hides the ontological difference between a union or a society of members and its actions by putting them under the distribution of divisible things. And this problem is made all the worse in a commercial society like ours, for whom exchanges constitute the origin and the end of all social activity. Since the 1960s, the Catholic tradition has not resolved what counts at the very least as a serious tension between distributive and common good justice. At the magisterial level, these two modes of justice are usually juxtaposed without any kind of historical narrative or philosophical synthesis. Look at quote number 4. This is from the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Catholic Church. The principle of the common good to which every aspect of social life must be related, if it is to attain its fullest meaning, stems from the dignity, unity, equality of all people. According to its primary and broadly accepted sense, the common good indicates, quote, the sum total of social conditions which allow people, either as groups or as individuals, to reach their fulfillment more fully and easily. It's quoting Gaudium et Spes, which is quoting Mater Magister of John 23rd. Woo, that's definitely a divisible thing. Some totals are divisible things. But without missing a beat, the next sentence: the common good does not consist in the simple sum of particular goods of each subject of a social entity. Belonging to everyone and to each person, it is and remains common because it is indivisible, and because only together is it possible to attain it, increase it, and safeguard its effectiveness. Just as the moral actions of an individual are accomplished in doing what is good, so too the actions of a society attain to their full stature when they bring about the common good. The common good, in fact, can be understood as the social and community dimension of the moral good. These are contradictory definitions. The first identifies the common good with an aggregation and says our main duty is to make sure that the aggregation gets distributed properly. The second position on the common good says common good is not an aggregation, it's indivisible. It's the second definition that's the traditional one. The one that Pius XI insisted was not being displaced by the new term social justice. So if you spin the reel ahead 30 years, Cardinal Schoenbrunn is leading a team to write the new Catechism of the Catholic Church. Look at quote 5. Schoenbrunn, being a Dominican and knowing the mind of Aquinas, includes these two brief remarks. At number 1910 in the Catechism, each human community possesses a common good, which permits it to be recognized as such. It is in the political community that its most complete realization is found. Second, one distinguishes commutative justice from legal justice, which concerns what the citizen owes in fairness to the community, and from distributive justice, which regulates what a community owes its citizens in proportion to their contributions and needs. It was a valiant effort of Schoenbrunn to try to correct the confusion. But look at quote number 6. It's the last one I referred to. It's from Benedict XVI, 2009, Caritas in Veritate. Quote, "Another important consideration is the common good. To love someone is to desire that person's good and to take effective steps to secure it. Besides the good of the individual, there is a good that's linked to living in society, the common good. It's the good of all of us made up of individuals, families, and immediate groups who together constitute society. It is a good that is sought not for its own sake, but for the people who belong to the social community and can only really and effectively pursue their good within it. The common good, according to Aquinas, is amor amicitia, something that's love with the love of friendship. It's always loved for its own sake. It's never loved as a mere instrument. What's quite striking here is that Benedict returns to the definition of the common good as the sum total of conditions. And what's even more interesting is that the Catechism, which included the corrections, was done under the direction of and the signature of Joseph Ratzinger, prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. There are some other quotations there you can look at in which it's pretty clear to me he's identifying common good with distribution and redistribution as a sum total of conditions. Maybe Ratzinger really saw the problem because he doesn't like the word redistribution, maybe. And maybe we could say that distributive justice is a part of common good justice, inasmuch as distributive justice always has its primary agent, the group, whether it's the polity, the church, the family, or other associations having a common good. It's we who owe our individual members. And in that sense, you can say that distributive justice is kind of like an instrument of common good justice. But Benedict does not say that. Nor does he note the analogical understandings of either distributive or common good justice. I say that the Catholic tradition is in a rut on this. It's holding something close to being contradictory positions, which are usually resolved by juxtapositions that don't synthesize and put into clear order the relation between the two. So, I return to Professor Haldane's note about a Catholic approach. The problem of social justice, a Catholic approach. Which approach? Does social justice mean distributions and redistributions? Or does social justice mean what we owe to an indivisible common good? Which approach? It has not been straightened out by the magisterium. You probably didn't come here expecting me to say that the post-1961 Catholic tradition of social thought is very intellectually lazy. It is not rigorous on this issue. It's very spongy. Maybe it's only Thomas who wants to see it sorted out. But in the meantime, until it's sorted out, I recommend that you take your lessons from Guido del Duca in the Purgatorio. He'll explain this. Thank you.